While much of the action that we were covering in Los Angeles, California, during the Democratic National Convention was taking place in the streets, and much of what was happening in the suites was tied to campaign contributions and fundraising, there was an event that was held at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in L.A. that we attended entitled The Challenge of the Global Economy, co-sponsored by the Campaign for America's Future and the Sierra Club under the banner The Progressive Call. The Challenge of the Global Economy brought together several speakers to talk about globalization and its ramifications. We bring you some excerpts from this forum and panel discussion, in particular Lydia Lester with United Students Against Sweatshops and Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. We also spoke with Congressman Barney Frank, who was in attendance and took part in the Challenge of the Global Economy Forum. And we're with Congressman Barney Frank. Congressman Frank, can you let our listeners know about the event that you're attending today, and why are you here?
Well, we're going to be talking about globalization. This is one of the areas where the Democratic Party is A, better than the Republican Party, but B, not good enough. And the important job for an activist who's morally serious is to keep both aspects of that in mind. The important job for an activist, I think, is both to understand the moral relevance of making the best possible choice you can make at any given time, but of also working so that the next time you have to make a choice, you have a better set of choices. Now, globalization is an example. I do think it makes sense to have international trade. I think it makes sense for us as a very wealthy nation to try to reach out and share our prosperity with poor nations, but not in the way it's been done. It's been done essentially until fairly recently as the kind of international version of trickle-down economics. And what many of us who are here together are working for is an effort to come together with a progressive globalization policy, a policy that does extend the benefits of the modern economy to places in the world where it hasn't been, but not at the cost of degrading the rights of working people or the environment.
When you say the Democrats are better than the Republicans, the Clinton-Gore administration has, in many respects, been at the vanguard of advancing globalization.
That was true until fairly recently. But you will remember that in Seattle, President Clinton said that he would not sign a new round unless it included environmental rights and labor rights. That was very badly received by many people, including some people overseas, and by the Republicans. So I think that would have been a fair criticism to have made 4 years ago. I think after the Democrats in 1997 in the House in particular blocked the extension of fast-track authority, we finally got the president's attention. And that's why I do think, while I've been critical, for instance, I voted against China normal trade relations, as they call it, the president did, to his credit, refuse to go forward with a new round in Seattle and said that he wanted to incorporate labor rights and environmental rights. So we're making some progress there. It's not nearly enough, but it's better than the Republicans.
Speaking of rights, you've been an outspoken champion of civil rights, human rights. I'd like to ask you, I've been out in the streets amongst the various protesters and people who feel very, very alienated from both parties and the political system as a whole in the United States. I'd like to ask you, what do you say to them so they can believe that they'll be included in a grassroots globalization, if you will?
Well, partly that their exclusion is self-imposed. You know, people say, well, gee, this convention doesn't have any real meaning, it's just a ratifying decision. That's right. That's because 32 years ago, after the 1968 Democratic nominating process, people said, we're tired of having the public's wishes ignored. So you have the candidates nominated now by the people who choose to vote in the primaries and caucuses. And when people refuse to vote in primaries and caucuses, they're ceding their right to have an influence. You know, the American political party, certainly this is true of the Democratic Party, is no monolithic entity. It is whoever happens to be showing up the polls on primary day. And I would urge people to get involved, and we do make some progress. We were able to get legislation passed to extend debt relief to the poorest countries in the world, and in a way that does not enhance the negative aspects of globalization. We managed to take out debt relief from some of the approaches of the IMF that we felt would have been damaging to poor people. So we do make some progress. The World Bank just effectively turned down a loan to the People's Republic of China because of the negative effect it would have on the native people in Tibet. Well, that's not everything, but it's better than not, and it happened through political action.
The shadow conventions have been running concurrent with the Democratic National Convention. Can I get your thoughts on the work they're doing over there?
Yes, I think they are mistaken in one level, and that is to deny that there are big differences between the Democrats and the Republicans. There's a plague on both your houses. As I said, if Al Gore wins, abortion will be a constitutional right. If George Bush wins, it won't be. If Al Gore wins, gay and lesbian people will continue to be treated fairly in a number of ways by the federal government. If George Bush wins, they won't be. This notion that there's no difference between the parties seems to me wrong. I think you have the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. They're both very effective. I think the most sensible thing to do is to try and make whichever one of those is closer to your views work better for you. I don't think the shadow convention is going to accomplish anything other than to make some people feel good. But I don't see any connection between the shadow convention and real action.
What about the issue of big money in politics in both major parties?
Oh, it's a problem. I don't understand how going to a shadow convention affects it one way or the other. As a matter of fact, the Democrats did finally, we were late, come around to a reform bill, the McCain-Feingold or Shays-Meehan bill, as it's called in the House, and we tried to restrict the influence of money. I think we should try to reform campaign finance, but I don't understand how sitting by yourselves and feeling morally superior accomplishes that, frankly.
Congressman Barney Frank, thank you.
Welcome.
Bob Borsage moderated the Challenge of the Global Economy Forum.
One of the movements that's transformed this debate has been the Students Against Sweatshops, where students on campuses have taken on the great corporations, Phil Knight and Nike, and have made them scramble for cover. And in campus after campus, they have forced their universities to begin to have directly the kinds of rules and regulations that Barney was just talking about being necessary for the global economy. Phil Knight started, he said, this is a joke, we aren't affected by this. And about a year later, he said he thought it would take 10 years for Nike's reputation to recover. I'm pleased to introduce to you Lydia Lester, who is a member of Students Against Sweatshops at the University of Arizona, a leader of their effort to create rules around their own purchasing, the university's own purchasing, and standards for the corporations that they contract with. She's a member of the Southern Arizona Alliance for Economic Justice. She's going to be a junior at Arizona, and she majors in linguistics. She first got involved in Students Against Sweatshops by joining a sit-in on the campus, trying to bring the administration to account. Now, it's interesting, when I asked her to come and speak, she's here with her affinity group demonstrating in the streets. And I asked her to come and speak, and she was not at all clear she wanted to talk to Democrats.
Yeah, we're not all Democrats.
And it was sort of revealing. This is a movement that I believe is transforming American campuses, is challenging the greatest corporations, and has added a remarkable new energy to the fight on globalization. And yet, it was striking to me that one of their leaders didn't even know whether it was worthwhile talking to a bunch of Democrats. It's a pleasure to introduce Lydia Lester.
Thank you. I want to thank the campaign for the Future of America for inviting me in the Sierra Club as well. Hope you can all see me over this podium here. As Bob said, I'm not, or as you probably guessed from what he said, I'm not a Democrat, nor do I support the Democratic Party. I came here today straight off the streets of LA, where I've been demonstrating with thousands of other people against the Democratic Party. Though there are many issues that the people have come here to address, the common thread is that the Democratic Party has consistently failed to represent the needs of the majority of people in the United States. The Democrats continue to kowtow to the wealthy and to the corporations. I do recognize that there are some politicians, like the ones on this panel, who have pursued a progressive agenda under the name of the Democratic Party. But I also recognize that a progressive agenda can be more effectively pursued through grassroots action and through third parties that are based on the needs of people over profits. I'm here today with a group of people from Tucson, Arizona. And like so many other people on the streets, we're protesting the Democratic National Convention because we have seen the effects of the Clinton-Gore administration in our communities. I will now read a statement that outlines some of the problems we have seen with both the Republicans and the Democrats. We are protesting at the Democratic Party Convention because both the Democrats and the Republicans represent a two-party system dominated by the big corporations. The Clinton-Gore administration of the Democratic Party, backed by the pro-corporate Republicans at every turn, has failed to support labor rights, human rights, environmental protection, and the needs of people of color. The corporate trade policy. The Clinton-Gore administration, with Republican backing, pushed through NAFTA, the WTO, and the China trade bill despite a broad coalition of labor, environmentalists, and human rights activists who oppose them and who will probably represent majority opinion among Americans. Welfare reform. The Clinton-Gore administration, with Republican backing, reformed welfare, driving hundreds of thousands into even more desperate conditions. Social Security. The Democrats, like the Republicans, are willing to reform the Social Security system to endanger secure retirement and other benefits for the majority so that corporate speculators can gain access to Social Security money. The border policy. The Clinton-Gore administration, with Republican backing, has imposed militarization and a repressive immigration policy along the U.S.-Mexico border, resulting in the deaths of more than 500 immigrants in the past few years. Yet policies like NAFTA promoted by both parties are what caused or worsened economic conditions in Mexico, thus driving people to try to enter the U.S. What's worse, both the Democratic and Republican parties seek to turn American workers against immigrants to distract them from those parties' own anti-labor policies. Mexican and American workers need to cooperate to improve conditions on both sides of the border and resist the multinational corporate agenda represented by the NAFTA and the WTO. The death penalty. The Clinton-Gore administration, with Republican backing, passed the Effective Death Penalty Act, which makes it more difficult for potentially innocent people to appeal death sentences, and which takes away the rights of habeas corpus. Free Mumia. The Democrats recently chose as chairman of their national committee a Philadelphia politician who helped railroad black journalist activist Mumia Abu-Jamal onto death row. Both Democrats and Republicans are resisting the demand for a new trial for Mumia, despite numerous constitutional violations in his original trial. Criminalization of youth. The Clinton-Gore administration, with Republican backing, has constantly promoted the prison-industrial complex and the criminalization of youth, especially young African Americans and Latinos. There are 2 million people in prison in the U.S. compared to only 200,000 a few years ago, and 75% to 80% are young people of color. The environment. The Clinton-Gore record on environmental protection is even worse than the Bush-Reagan record. The Democrats keep granting corporations logging, mining, oil exploration, cattle grazing, and other privileges on public lands at the same time that they claim to expand the number of national parks and other protected areas. Reinventing government. This Gore policy has resulted in the loss of tens of thousands of jobs for unionized federal workers, according to the American Federation of Government Employees, which, like the auto workers and the Teamsters, long refused to endorse Gore. Healthcare. Polls show that a big majority favor universal health care in this country instead of HMOs, but neither the Democrats nor the Republicans will move in that direction. They're in the pay of the insurance companies and the health care for-profit-only industry. The pro-corporate two-party stranglehold on politics doesn't allow majority views, as on health care, to become public policy. Election reform. Neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have done anything serious to get corporate money out of politics, despite all the talk about campaign finance reform. Neither party supports proportional representation, which would give minorities greater political voice. An alternative political party is needed, one not dominated by the corporate agenda, but speaking for, responsible to, and controlled by labor, people of color, and the environmental movement. I hope that some of the progressive Democrats here today can see that the changes that need to happen in the U.S. today have not and cannot occur within the Democratic Party. I represent a movement of people that is ready to see a society that is truly democratic and for the people. Beyond demonstrating in the streets, we are constantly making more connections and forming coalitions to see the end of corporate rule in the U.S. and the world. Our movement is constantly growing, as evidenced by the demonstrations in Seattle, D.C., Philadelphia, and now in Los Angeles. I've been involved with the anti-sweatshop movement for about a year and a half that's been occurring on the university campuses around the country. When I first started, there was only a handful of campuses involved, and today there's over 200 campuses involved. The most important message that I want to bring here today is that we have not seen a progressive agenda pursued within the Democratic Party as a whole, and that its closeness with the corporate agenda prevents it from addressing the needs of the people. Third parties such as the Labor Party and the Green Party represent the grassroots efforts that can bring about change the American people need. So the global challenge is to change the political and economic systems to truly serve the people, not the corporations and the wealthy. Thank you.
Jesse Jackson Jr. burst on the political scene already a star. But he sort of fooled people, I think. He's very different than his father. Yes, he has the same ability to rouse a crowd. He has the same remarkable intelligence. But, for example, Jr. is a good organizer.
And interested in it.
That's right.
He created the best website in the Congress. He has the largest mailing list of activists around the country of anybody in the House of Representatives. He's organizing across the country in the theory that you can create a progressive movement and organize it, and unlike George McGovern, not lose the mailing list,
right.
And unlike Jesse Jackson, not forget about continuing to build it. It's a pleasure to he also fought a furious fight last year over the Africa trade bill. And he did something that all of us must emulate, I think. He presented his own bill, Hope for Africa, that laid out the alternative, debt relief for the African countries, not simply forcing them to keep paying back a debt that can never be repaid. More aid and assistance for health and education so that, in fact, their people have a chance to begin to lift themselves up from the bottom, not a continuation of IMF structures that force cuts in aid and health care and force them back down to the bottom. And then fair trade grounded on labor rights and environmental protections so that they do not simply become the cheap depots of multinational corporations. Now, for that, he was, as Barney said, he received enormous criticism. There were a lot of members of the Black Caucus, a lot of members of the liberal community that thought it was better to get something than nothing for Africa. And so they went with a bill that they knew was flawed, that had none of those elements, rather than with Hope for Africa. But by fighting that fight and by showing the alternative, he helped all of the country and certainly all of the Congress learn much more about the elements of what a true internationalism would be. Jesse Jackson, Jr.
Thank you. Let me thank Bob Borsarch for that very kind introduction. As a matter of fact, my remarks are going to be unusually brief because everything that he said in that introduction was what I was going to say here today. But being brief would be very unusual for being a Jackson, so I'm not going to do that either. I am going to honor my time commitment. I want to thank America's Future for having the wisdom to put on this dialogue and this panel. And I also want to thank all of you, particularly those who are sitting on the platform, because I do long for the day when we are inside of the convention and we are delivering the keynote address with most of corporate America on the outside protesting. So, you've heard from everyone else on the panel about what's wrong with trade and why we should not be engaged in the kind of trade that's being advocated in this Congress and on both tickets. I want to provide a framework, however, for what I think is an alternative that we can fight for. I remember the great NAFTA debate between Al Gore and Ross Perot. Al Gore argued that trade created jobs, and Ross Perot argued that it cost jobs. What no one in the media articulated clearly was that both men were right. They just weren't talking about the same people. Al Gore was right that they created jobs, but for the most educated, the most affluent members of our society who could benefit and take advantage of free trade. So Linda Lake and her analysis of the polls indicated that. Ross Perot was also right in that it cost jobs. Jobs from the former industrialized economy exported them to Mexico and unregulated markets in other parts of the world. So when the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act came before the Congress of the United States, I was fundamentally opposed to it in the last session of the Congress. And I made the determination that at some point in time we have to have a trade bill, something that we as working men and women in this country can be for and not use all of our energy to be against something. But there were a couple of balances that we had to strike. The first balance that we must strike is the balance between job creation and industrial preservation. The next balance that we must strike is between our democratic values and our global responsibility. We must also strike the balance between economic growth for all, where no American is left behind, but we must also have balanced economic growth in our world, where we are citizens and participants in a global economic environment. And this can only be accomplished, I genuinely believed, by raising the standards of living in the world without sacrificing any of our own living standards. So, if you are against NAFTA and you are here today, would you give me a round of applause? If you are against growth and opportunity in Africa, clap. If you are against NAFTA for Africa, clap. What the conservatives in the Congress were essentially able to do was take terms that we could not fundamentally be against, like growth and opportunity for Africa, and creatively, essentially give Africa what they gave us in NAFTA. Now, if you are against NAFTA for Africa, again, would you clap? As long as liberals and progressives like Barney and myself did not have an alternative, there were very few progressives in the Congress who wanted to vote against a bill that was seen as helping Africa. Because after all, we have to go back to our congressional districts and explain to African Americans, Hispanics, and working class men and women that we are fighting for things that they want us to fight for. So we must be at least sensitive enough and clear enough to know that Democrats and Republicans use creative terms to mislead the American people on some critical questions so that they can be the beneficiaries of an elite global marketplace. So, we established a premise that human rights, opportunity, partnership, and empowerment ought to be the premise of every trade bill. Its acronym, in short, is HOPE, Human Rights, Opportunity, and Partnership and Empowerment. I believe we not only need a HOPE for Africa, but we need a HOPE for China. We need a HOPE for South America. We need a HOPE for the Caribbean. And the language that we ought be using ought be language that's consistent with human rights, opportunity, partnership, and empowerment for those countries towards raising their standards of living without undermining our own. I thought that the best way to do this, one, was the issue of debt relief. It ought to be addressed in every one of our trade bills. We cannot separate the issue of debt relief from our trade bills. Why? Because the per capita earning income of many countries around the world, for their citizens, they are earning pennies on the dollar. And in that economic environment, many corporations that seek to do business in those countries are going to close their plants in our country and organize and open them up in those countries. Debt relief is a significant factor in that. That is, those countries come to the table arguing and bargaining from a position of no strength when they come into contact with the global economy. The export earning potential of these countries is undermined by debt owed by these nations to the international financial institutions and speculators, debt that's usually occurred and accrued under undemocratic and tyrannical regimes. You cannot hold the people of the Congo responsible for what Mobutu did, no more than you can hold Mandela responsible for loans that were given to their country in an undemocratic, pro-apartheid regime. And so debt forgiveness so that the people of Soweto and the people in the Congo and the people of Nigeria, the people of Mozambique, the people of Brazil should not be forced to pay back with their hard-earned labor debts that were squandered, that were undemocratically acquired. That should be eliminated. Now, I just want to add a couple of other brief observations. Self-determination must be a part of all of our trade bills. The Hope for Africa Act stated that a new U.S. policy toward Africa must be based on the recognition that economic development must be measured by the well-being of the majority of the people and oriented toward the following goals: strengthening and diversifying, in this case, Africa's economic production capacity, improving the level of people's incomes and the patterns of distribution, adjusting the pattern of public expenditures to satisfy people's essential needs, providing institutional support for transition through debt relief, supporting sustainable development, and promoting democracy, human rights, and strength of civil society. We went even further than that. We provided business facilitation, foreign aid, a review process, and the reason the Sierra Club supported our bill is because our bill gave governing authority for all environmental issues, that of which was U.S. law. And it gave U.S. citizens standing in federal court to sue U.S. multinationals who are not following U.S. law in foreign labor markets abroad, which is the only way we can enforce our laws in a foreign land. Now, let me close on this note. And Bob touched upon it in his introduction, and that is one of why we should be organized. I, at one point in time, was a student, and had I not been a member of Congress, would probably at this convention find myself on the outside protesting with this young lady. But I really want you to hear what I want to say about that. Very little that she said today do I disagree with. But at some point in time, we have to transition what she said into the power to do something about it. If I were on the outside of the Congress, I would not have been able to present the Hope Bill. I have to be in the Congress, on the floor of the Congress, challenging Republicans and challenging Democrats. And to be very honest with you, sometimes I feel like a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. Kicking Democrats and Republicans in the ass as much as I'm kicking everybody else in the behind, because I'm towards her vision. Now, I can do that on the outside, or I can do that on the inside as a member of Congress trying to affect public policy and do something about it. And so I respect fundamentally these positions. Here's the principle of organizing that I think we have to follow, which is why my website is what it is and does what it does. An organized minority is a political majority. Lowest voter turnout in the nation's history expected in November. The group that is organized the most doesn't require hundreds of millions of people to agree. The organized minority is the political majority. The most organized group will win on November if three people show up. We need two. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say it again. If three people show up to vote, we need two. Yes, we need more voter registration and more turnout, but guess what? If all of the free traders are asleep in November and the fair traders show up to vote, we win. The organized minority is the political majority. So first and foremost, we must be organized. Secondly, believe it or not, with all of the corporate nature of the Republican convention and certainly the corporate nature of the Democratic convention, we must not be naive that it's going to take a lot of money to beat all this money. That's sad, but that's the tragic irony. To stop all of the money that we see influencing our nation's politics, it's going to take a lot of money to stop the money. Some of us are not part of the corporate elite that's constantly running around Los Angeles and running around Philadelphia doing fundraisers and raising money. They're all part of that. I've not been to one fundraiser since I've been here. Barney indicated before the program began that he's not been to any fundraisers since he's been here. But now listen to this. If Barney and I don't raise some money, it'll be two less voices here at the next convention. So it's going to take money to keep Barney in Congress and money to keep Jesse Jr. in Congress to keep our position. You have to raise money to beat the money. Amen?
Mm-hmm.
Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, lastly, this ought to be our last convention that we come here where our position is not represented on the ticket. Amen.
Mm-hmm.
But that will only come if an organized minority is helping its candidates, inspiring its voters, and participating in the process. And then, when we don't get our way for not participating in the process, guess what? We should not pack our bags and go home. I know I've taken over my time, but that's also wrong and unfair. And I say that as, other than Barney, the most progressive person in the Congress. I spoke to 1,500 people the other day who are supporting another candidate running for president, and I asked them, where were they during the Paul Wellstone organizing effort?
With Paul.
Some of you were. But many of the people who've been arguing and complaining at the end of the process were not there when Paul Wellstone announced initially his campaign for this process. He supports us. He's with us. He believes in what we're about. But at the end of the process, now that the big money influences have essentially taken control of both of the Senate and their interests are covered, many of us are complaining at the tail end of it. Paul Wellstone is a Hope Bill supporter. Paul Wellstone was a campaign finance supporter. Paul Wellstone wants to bring young people frustrated on the outside into the convention. We have to be organized on the front side of the process and not just on the tail end of the process. And so I look forward to working with all of you over the next couple of years and over the next couple of decades, God willing, to help change America, build a more perfect union for all Americans, but also build a more perfect world. Thank you very much.
During question and answer time, we had the opportunity to ask Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. and Lydia Lester a question.
Mike Thornton, KVMR FM Radio. I have two questions. I'll keep them brief. One for Representative Jackson. Sir, would you be in favor and support having Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan included in the presidential debates this year? And one for Lydia Lester. Lydia, what could the Democratic Party do, tangibly do, to make you and other people involved in the protest in the streets feel that they could be a partner in alliance for progressive democratic change? And I'd like your answers. Thank you very much.
I am the proud sponsor of HCON Resolution 373, which is the presidential debates bill, and probably the only reason I've not been allowed to be on the platform at the Democratic Convention this year is because my bill reduces the threshold in presidential debates from 15% to 5% so that Mr. Nader and Mr. Buchanan can participate in presidential debates. And now, I say that to say that it's not just good for Democrats, it's good for the democracy. It's not just good for Republicans, it's good for the Republic. It's not just good for libertarians, it's good for liberty. And it's not just good for the Green Party, it's good for greener pastures. Now, this is going to be very, very quick, Bob, but I want to say this. When you look at the intent of Congress on the issue of presidential debates with the establishment of that commission, it has two purposes written in the legislation. Number one, to increase voter participation. And number two, to broaden a range of views between and amongst the parties. That's Congress's intent. The 15% threshold is an arbitrary requirement from the Presidential Debates Commission that established the credibility of candidates at 15%, which is a threshold that is obviously too high for third party and lesser candidates to meet. And that's why there are a number of federal lawsuits right now challenging the arbitrariness of that threshold. There is a gulf between Congress's intent and what the Presidential Debates Commission, which is comprised of three Democrats on the one hand and three Republicans on the other. So it's never in their interests to ensure that candidates are participating in the debates. That's the nature of the beast. And anytime you have candidates who share the same views on trade, who share the same views on the death penalty, who share the same views essentially on a number of other issues, while there are tremendous distinctions and differences which Reverend Jackson talked about in his speech last night, it's important to have more views represented in that debate. I support a moratorium, and I'm the only person in the Congress who's established and pushed for a moratorium bill in the United States Congress. And it is the only, there is no moratorium question being raised amongst both candidates who support the death penalty.
Lydia.
For example.
I think, quite simply, a very important part is to indeed allow a voice for people like Nader to you know, express their views. I think, I mean, if you turn on, like, the news today, you would think that Gore and Bush are the only candidates running, and I don't think that there's enough space in the media, in the mainstream media, for what the people that are on the streets, what they're doing. I don't think that there's enough representation of what their ideas are.
From the Hyatt Regency Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, California, and the panel discussion of the challenge of the global economy, I'm Mike Thornton, reporting for the Western Slopes News Service.